of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to order for Friday, February 10th. Welcome, members. Welcome all who are here. And as I was mentioning to one of our members, I think the passwords for today are rigid flexibility. So we will be working through the agenda. We might need to take some brief recesses along the way to incorporate the work. And we will get started. Members, we'll be a little bit out of order. We're going to wait on the Senate Bill 1580 for a few minutes till we know we have the materials that we need. So I would like to start off by opening a work session, please, on the Department of Justice Intellectual Property Crime Federal Grant. If you are ready, Representative Greg Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, the Public Safety Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means approve the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Justice for a one-year grant to enhance investigations related to intellectual property crime. The Department of Justice is requesting permission to apply for a federal grant from the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Justice Assistance to enhance state and local investigations related to intellectual property crimes. The grant is for 1 year, starting October 1st, 2012, and the agency will apply for approximately $200,000. Grant funds will be used for conducting investigations across the state targeting swap meets and open-air markets where counterfeit products have been previously sold. In addition, a training conference will be held to educate investigators and prosecutors in the area of crime. Your Public Safety Subcommittee recommends approval.
Thank you, Representative. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. I'd like to open a work session on agency reports. We'll start with Department of Administrative Services. Senator Whitson, please.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. The General Government Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report on the state debt service savings as a result of refinancing from the Department of Administrative Services. On November 9, 2011, the Department of Administrative Services and the State Treasurer completed the sale of Article 11Q 2011 Series N, O, and P bonds. Proceeds from the sale of the Series O and P bonds were used to refinance qualifying certificates of participation that have been issued previously. The State Treasurer has determined that bonds qualify for refinancing when the present value savings is 3% or more of the original issued amount. The refunding resulted in current biennium general fund debt service savings of $81,641 for the Department of Corrections, $82,296 for the Department of Public Safety, Standards and Training, and $2,581 for the Military Department. Total general fund savings over the life of the bonds will be about $2 million. The bonds were refinanced for the same length of term as the original debt. All of these savings for the refinancing have been accounted for by the co-chair's budget rebalance plan of 2011-13 biennium. The General Government Subcommittee recommends approval. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Close that work session. Open work session, please. Department of Administrative Services, 10% Administrative Reduction Plan, and Motor Pool Utilization. Representative Garrard, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. The General Government Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report from the Department of Administrative Services on a plan to reduce administrative functions by 10% and a report on usage of state motor pool vehicles. The budget report for SB 5502, the primary 2011-13 budget bill for the department, included a budget note directing the agency to report back during the 2012 legislative session on the following topics. One, a progress report on a plan for reducing 2013-15 administrative functions, such as information technology and human resources, across the executive branch of state government by 10%. The agency reported that criteria for the plan has been established, scope definition and measurement work is underway, and the department is making sure the plan fits into the new budget process. Item two, various aspects of the agency's management of the state motor pool, along with providing information on fleet authorities and exemption criteria, the department reported that agencies are turning in underutilized vehicles for fleet reassignment. a replacement schedule that considers vehicle type, vehicle age, monthly mileage, fuel efficiency, and residual value also has been adopted. The subcommittee requested the agency on the recent flood, questioned the agency on the recent flood event that damaged motor pool vehicles. The department acknowledged it had handled that incident and other flood-related issues poorly, but is taking action to improve reaction times and plan for flood behavior that may be different from past experiences. Your general government subcommittee recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you, Representative. Discussion on the motion, Representative Whitson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wonder if the co-chair of the committee would address the to the rest of the members if they look if the report discusses the elimination or reduction of public affairs and advertising. We had a bill in our committee that died was going to that was a subject that had the public's attention, and did that get addressed by as part of this plan to reduce 10%?
Thank you, Representative. Which particular co-chair would you like to respond?
Mr. Garrard.
Mr. Co-chair, Representative Wisnett, there was no discussion. This was basically a focus on the 10-year overall plan and not of anything immediate.
Thank you. Their follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask that DAS, then, since we did not move a bill, that had a lot of the public's attention about how much money is being spent in advertising and public affairs, and I would hope that they would, as they implement this plan, they would look at that expenditure. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion?
Good.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Close the work session, open work session, Department of Administrative Services, internal audits. So Representative Nathanson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The General Government Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report from the Department of Administrative Services on statewide internal audit activities. ORS 184.360, sub 6, requires the Department to submit an annual report to the legislature on internal audits. The report, which describes internal audit activities as directed by the statute, covers the fiscal year ending June 2011 and was completed in December 2011. The report includes an outline of strategic direction for statewide internal audit, background on internal audit governance, and a summary by agency of internal audits and associated activities completed in fiscal year 2011. The subcommittee discussed the impacts of declining resources on internal audit functions and the potential opportunities to move toward an enterprise approach, especially in higher risk areas. I'm going to paraphrase here. This report is about making sure someone's minding the store. Your General Government Subcommittee recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you, Representative. Is there discussion on the motion?
Yeah.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Members, we're going to skip over item number 4 temporarily. We'll come back to it. Open work session, item number 5, Oregon Government Ethics Commission Training Program. Representative Garrard, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The General Government Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report from the Oregon Government Ethics Commission on progress made in streamlining its training program. The budget report for House Bill 5024 and the 2011-13 budget bill for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission included the following note, quote, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission shall report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means during the February 2012 legislative session on progress being made in streamlining its training program utilizing the Internet, webinars, and virtual learning and other technology. The agency reported on 6 specific actions it has taken to improve delivery of training programs using technology. These include increasing bandwidth, conducting webinars, and producing audio training modules. The subcommittee discussed the potential for agency costs to shift over time from personal services or travel to technology support. Your General Government Subcommittee recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you, Representative. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Members will skip over temporarily item number 6 and move to item number 7, Department of Human Services, the Long-Term Care System. Representative Cowan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report on the long-term care system for seniors and people with disabilities. Oregon's long-term care system faces challenges due to a growing senior population, an increasing number of individuals with disabilities, and state and federal funding constraints. A budget note in the Department of Human Services budget report asked the governor to convene a work group to study and make recommendations to preserve and enhance Oregon's system. Two different work groups focused on different areas of the system. The first work group looked at services and supports to help prevent or delay the need for Medicaid services for those who do not currently receive them. The second work group looked at the blend of resources, alignment, and efficiencies for individuals eligible for Medicare, Medicaid, and Medicaid long-term services and supports within the broader healthcare transformation effort. The report lays out in detail a number of opportunities and recommendations, leveraging aging and disability resource connection models statewide, commonly known as ARDCs, use of Oregon Project Independence as part of a larger prevention and early intervention continuum, look at more preventative programs for what is commonly referred to as the pre-Medicaid population. We're looking for a better word for that. Pursue flexibility in rules and resources to cut costs and increase matching funds. Develop models of service coordination between the new coordinated care organizations and the long-term care system. And put in place shared accountability mechanisms such as processes and outcome measures and financial incentives to reduce risks of cost shifts between the CCOs and the long-term care system. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends acknowledging the receipt of this report, and I would also like to thank the many people who put in a lot of hours really doing a lot of research on this. The reports are actually very interesting.
Thank you, Representative. Is there discussion on this motion? Senator Whitsitt, please.
Thank you. Just a comment, just how important this focus on long-term care is. I believe the statistics that I've seen, the population of Oregon is increasing at about a 1.2% rate, but the rate of increase in the age 65 to 74 is at 4.9. So this is a problem we can't ignore. It is coming at us, and it I think that we need to start focusing resources get out ahead of this curve. I know that we're putting a lot of money into early learning council and that sort of thing. I don't demean that in any way, but this problem is coming at us, and is coming at us like a tsunami.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Representative Cowell, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Senator Whitsitt's comments. Just for information, the latest numbers that I've seen indicate that Oregon truly does have an exemplary system. We average approximately 24 individuals per 1,000 in the over age 65 age bracket who are actually requiring nursing home care. The national average is 42 per 1,000 in that age bracket. It's because of our early interventions and our community-based long-term care. What we're looking to do is to make that as solid as possible, help people with options counseling and making decisions that will help them extend their own assets and hopefully not be needing state-funded services, but it all needs to be part of the picture that we're looking at.
Thank you, Representative. Co-Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to just make one comment, and that is whenever we're discussing long-term care systems for seniors, I believe we need to bring up the need for end-of-life planning. I mean, far too many times our seniors go forward as if they're going to live forever and don't really address the reality that when that final phase comes, do they want to be hooked up with tubes in a hospital? They want multiple emergency trips to the hospital? Or would they rather plan ahead with physician certificates of whatever the orange or the purple sheet is, or that, or
advanced
directives, just different ways to make sure that their desires are known while they're still competent and able to make those decisions, and we don't put their children, adult children, in a situation of having to make decisions in a crisis mode under extreme emotional pressure. And you know, having been involved with the passing of four of our family members over the last 10 years, all at home, all very quiet and very peaceful with family around, I can tell you it is a much better option than often takes place. But it won't happen for a lot of people unless there's this discussed and there's training and there's questions asked and decisions made. So I just hope that we will keep end-of-life decisions as part of this discussion whenever we talk about long-term care. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Just have to weigh in to the discussion that Representative Dennison raised. And so some of you know that I went through the experience not too very long ago. It is one that I don't think any of us are really prepared for. And even when you go through it, the choices that have to be made are not something that one can, even if you do advance directories during that emotional process, are able to actually come to grips with. It's something that as a society we do not talk about, nor do we want to talk about in the life. We like to think that we're going to be here forever, and particularly when we're younger. And the other piece of it is that unlike years ago when we were actually more of a community and we stayed with grandma, grandpa, and what have you, we didn't see the evolution of life today like we did years and years ago. It is one for discussion. I don't know how you legislate it, though.
Just promote those conversations.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Representative Callan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. This is an area of considerable passion for me. And I'd like to follow up on those comments to say that when I mentioned options counseling and other such things that we are looking at within the spectrum of the Aging and Disability Resource Connection or other pieces of the Oregon Project Independence, I want to remind folks that that's really what the intention was, and some of the changes that we made to statute last session around the Oregon Project Independence statute. Too often we think of that only as providing an occasional in-home caregiver to someone who fits that criteria. In fact, we've expanded what's available under that statute so that we might do just exactly what you're talking about, encourage individuals to have those very, very, very difficult early conversations, both the family and the aging family member, to look at what the options are, to see what's available, and to make good life choices as we move through. Whatever is important, each individual situation is different, and it needs to be handled on an individual basis. But if we give folks resources that they can make rational decisions, they then are put in a position of being able to make the choices that's best for each and every family. And I think it's important that we remember that that is part of our community-based long-term care system, is an encouragement to individuals to have those difficult personal in-home decisions and then make choices that will be in their own best interest. Thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Hearing none, is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Close work session. Work session on item number 8. Department of Justice, key performance measures for the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program. Representative Nolan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The Public Safety Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report on the development of key performance measures for the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program. The program funds the defense of the state's position in cases where sentenced offenders appeal their conviction or their sentence. Attorneys and staff of the trial and appellate divisions bill this program for work defending criminal convictions. The program accounts for roughly one-third of the agency's general fund budget. The agency developed three KPMs. For the appellate division, a measure is proposed that tracks the number of days from when appellate division staff receives a case to when the brief for the case is filed. This is similar to measures used in the Public Defense Services Commission and the Oregon Judicial Department. which are the other two major state agencies connected with similar work. The measure will provide an indicator of whether justice is timely served. For the trial division, the agency is proposing two existing KPMs, but separating them out for results just within these types of cases. The first KPM is the percentage of legal cases where the state's position is upheld, which is a surrogate for demonstrating the success of the agency's work. The second measure is the percentage of appropriate litigation resolved through settlement, which is a way of measuring the number of cases where success can be achieved at reduced legal cost. Your Public Safety Subcommittee recommends acknowledgement of this report.
Thank you, Representative. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion carries. Close that work session. Open work session on item number 9, the Military Department 911 Consolidation. Senator Verger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Public Safety Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report on the merits of consolidating the state's 49 911 public safety answering points. The Military Department contracted with the nationally recognized firm J.R. Kimball to undertake the consolidation study. Kimball categorizes its analysis as an overview rather than a detailed plan for consolidation. The firm has undertaken similar analyses in other states and has noted a growing nationwide trend toward consolidation. The cost of the next generation 911 technology is seen as one of the primary drivers of consolidation. The Kimball analysis concludes that Oregon's emergency communication statewide would benefit from further consolidation efforts. The analysis goes on to say that while the consolidation process is complex and difficult, if implemented correctly, it can yield improvements in service levels, regional interoperability, responder safety, employee retention, and potential cost savings. Kimball's recommended solution would put into place 9 regional PSAP centers across the state. The Kimball analysis serves as a basis for future PSAP consolidation and technology upgrade discussions. The Public Safety Subcommittee recommends acknowledgement of the report.
Thank you, Senator. Is there discussion on the motion?
Does this thing have anything to do with our statewide radio project? It seems like we've got two separate things going here, and can't they be consolidated somewhere or another?
Senator, your response?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, that discussion was taking place at the committee, and that we think that there's a possibility that there could be some overlay to these communication systems, which would be great. And so thank you for bringing that up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senators. Further discussion? Hearing none, is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Closed work session, open work session, item number 10, Department of State Police, Office of State Medical Examiner Costs. Senator Monroe, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The Public Safety Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report on the costs and productivity of the Oregon State Police's Office of State Medical Examiner. The Oregon State Police was instructed in a budget note to report on the cost, workload, and productivity of the medical examiner's office compared to surrounding states. Oregon is one of roughly 20 states with a statewide medical examiner system, while the surrounding states still operate under a county coroner system. While this complicated the comparison required by the budget note, medical examiner still completed a comparison of the larger jurisdictions in Washington and California that use licensed forensic pathologists, which provide a fair comparison. The comparison found that Oregon's system was generally in line with costs and efficiencies with these other jurisdictions. Specifically, she found that Oregon had the lowest number of licensed forensic pathologists per capita, the lowest cost per case reported, and was in the middle of the group for cost per postmortem examination or autopsy. Your Public Safety Subcommittee recommends acknowledgement of the report.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion on the motion. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion carries. Folks, we'll jump back up now to the Department of Aviation Operations with Senator Verger standing in for Senator Johnson. Senator Verger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee recommends that the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of a report by the Oregon Department of Aviation on managing resources as required by budget note and direct the agency to provide the next report to the Emergency Board at the closest meeting to September 2012 and a final report during the 2013 legislative session. The legislative adopted budget for the Department of Aviation included a budget note requiring the agency to report quarterly on actions taken to improve its business practices. In its report, Aviation must outline what specific measures have been taken to address, first, how the organization will achieve its mission within a smaller organization, how the organization will resolve issues raised in the audit reports, how the organization will address the issue of registering pilots and aircraft, while other actions will the organization take to improve leadership and the consistent application of policies and practices, what the financial condition is of each of the major programs of the organization. This is the agency's third quarterly report. In regard to operating within a small organization, Aviation has completed the transfer of certain central business operation functions to the Department of Transportation. The agency also resolved most of the 42 issues raised in the audit reports for the agency. The report includes collection data for pilot and aircraft registrations and a chart showing reasons for 493 pilots who deactivated their registrations. Although the agency does not currently have the authority to impose penalties for non-registration, they may seek that authority in a future legislative session. Expenditures remain commensurate with revenue, and the agency has stated that if it continues to practice careful cash management, the agency has made considerable progress in taking management actions to address elements of the budget note. And because there won't be significantly different information to report in the next quarter, the subcommittee recommends that the department provide its next progress report in the fall and a final report during the 2013 legislative review of the 2013-15 budget. Your Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development recommends your approval.
Thank you, Senator. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Jumping back to the Department of Human Services Tandem Jobs Program, pinch hitting for Senator Bates. Senator Winters, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means acknowledge receipt of report on the temporary assistance of needy families in job opportunity and basic skills programs. The combined budget for the TANF and Jobs Program was 10% lower in 2011-13 than in 2009-11, with a 48% reduction to the Jobs Program budget. A budget note directed a review of the program changes, their impact on clients and program outcomes, and recommendations for improvements. The review found that without pre-TANF payments, families who need short-term help with housing or utility emergencies are applying for TANF cash assistance sooner. Families who had reduced grants or lost services reported more difficulty in paying for shelter, utilities, and other basic needs. The number of state TANF caseloads and case manager positions has been stagnant despite rapid caseload growth. Jobs contractors have lost the equivalent of 322 full-time employees. Family engagement in self-sufficiency plans has dropped and employment placements are lower. A separate review of new cases suggests more families enter TANF due to losing other financial support, not wages, or waiting for unemployment insurance. Fewer adults have any documented work history. In-migration is higher than a year ago, but most families new to the state continue to be from Washington and California. More caseload growth is happening in mid-sized counties, not the metropolitan areas. The report lays out both short-term and long-term recommendations for the programs. use $10 million budgeted but not yet allocated to buy job placement services for job-ready clients, work experience and summer services for near job-ready clients, and child care and transportation support for all job participants. Further assess the impact of the TANF and job reductions already made, and in the longer term, rebuild the TANF and jobs program as anticipated in 2007 House Bill 2469 to help families achieve family stability and economic security. Your Human Services Subcommittee recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion on the motion. Co-Chair Richardson, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, this issue with TANF is an ongoing concern. Mm-hmm. My recollection is that Oregon in recent parity periods has gone up in the use of TANF by 17%. It's easy to say, well, that's just because we're having hard times, but other states are having hard times as well. California, my understanding is, has in their budget reforms has limited TANF to a four-year period. Federally, it's supposed to be limited to 5 years. Oregon has a fairly easy extension ability where it's kind of like an emergency extension, and some information I've recently received has indicated that we have people on TANF who've been on for 84 months and are continuing on it. And so there is a risk that a population, I don't know what the size would be, who have a continuing need to utilize services will go where the services are offered. And so if California and Washington limit their TANF program, then we need to watch to make sure that we don't become a magnet for others to come into the state merely because we have better benefits than are available in the other states. So that is a concern, and I'm hoping that the agencies will watch for that and not merely draw conclusions as to why things are going up so much faster in our state than in other states, when there could be a direct relationship between our benefits, our eligibility requirements, and the flexibility of those, the length of service, and all of those things that we have that make Oregon a more attractive place to receive benefits than our adjoining states.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Representative Callan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to point out that another part of the conversation that we had when we heard this report was some detail from the agency regarding the jobs readiness by categories within the population of eligible people, remembering, of course, the jobs program is the process of trying to get people ready to work and to be able to be placed in the workplace. They categorize it in four separate sections based on readiness and the availability of staff to work with individuals in overcoming some of their barriers. And with the caseload increases and the staffing reductions, there is less ability to work with those who are more challenged than others with ancillary needs, be that chemical dependency issues or mental health issues or other things that would take a more intense amount of work. So it's an interesting continuing cycle that's difficult to deal with. The more energy to help people move out is helpful, and the less that we can do that, the more challenging it is for people to move into readiness. And then we also heard significant testimony about the need for child care availability, and I think it's important as we talk about jobs and helping create jobs and helping people fill them, that availability of child care is a critical factor for many families in order for them to move into the workplace and successful employment.
Thank you, Sam. For the discussion, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Would it be possible for someone, whoever dealt with this, to get me the definition of what temporary means?
Would you like someone to come up? And...
No. Right. If you could send me information, because I think what Co-Chair Richardson was sharing is a very valid point, and I don't understand the definition. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's an excellent point, and I think that actually getting clarity on what not only what the jobs program does, as Representative Cowan says, but what the different pieces of TANF are, it's important to understand as the social safety net that we have. Senator Winters and Representative Nolan. Senator Winters, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to continue, there's another part of the discussion that we held that I raised in committee, and I have received some of the information back, and that is by county, where are the needs? Because we always have the assumption that it's all out of the metropolitan or the urban centers, and given our high unemployment rate that we have in the state, how does the high unemployment rate correlate with TANF, and in what areas of our state are impacted the most, as well as what are the impacts with the various minority communities? And I need to put that in. Is there a disproportionate rate? So that was also part of the discussion that we held. It's hard for me, and I know that probably there may be a few that may individuals that between Washington and California, it's hard in this kind of climate to fully state that given the limited amount of resources that we give to people on TANF, that movement across state would be a priority. I think more than anything, when we look at TANF, we will probably find from a historical perspective that jobs is probably the underpinning of everything that happens in this program. And without jobs, and something that this building is fairly aware of, we still remain to be one of the highest in the nation. I think if we don't get busy, we can talk, TANF will grow. It won't go the other direction. And the other piece, it has to be tied to our educational system. So I just need to put that on record in case others are listening out in this world that we televise to, that it is more than just talking about whether we're having in-migration from California and Washington. Oregon needs to get busy on the whole task of creating meaningful employment.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Nolan, please.
Senator Winters eloquently made one of the points I wanted to make, but I just want to echo again, if we are wanting to make comparisons between the services that Oregon is providing and our adjacent states or other states, particularly as it affects people who genuinely have mobility, from my perspective, I am much more concerned about the reductions we've made in support for education and what that says to middle class and community committed families and whether they can find an attractive place to live and raise their families here in Oregon, what we've done to our universities and the absence of robust support for universities and whittling away at that capacity, our transportation system, our court system. Those are the services that really indicate whether we can attract the kinds of families and businesses to this state that we want to keep. And we should be just as mindful of the impact of budget decisions we're making on those and our attractiveness to building a prosperous community.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion on this motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Colleagues, we are still waiting for some paperwork to be finalized, so let us stand in recess until 9:30. Please return at 9:30. Going to call the Joint Committee on Ways and Means back to what passes for order on Friday, February 10th. Colleagues, we are going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1580. We're going to take things slow because there are three amendments that are going to be offered, and I want to make sure everybody follows the trail of the amendments. Any member who is at any point lost as we go through this process, including me, will have the ability to ask to pause and make sure we have clarity. As amendments are offered, the committee will take time to talk through the amendments so that they're understood. They'll be passed on, distributed. We will take time to do this. I do not want to rush through anything. I want to make sure every member understands what is being put before them and what is being voted on. So again, if you feel at any point you are getting lost in the trail, if you're off the trail of where this is, please do not hesitate to make Mr. Rocco explain where we are. And with that, I believe, Senator Bates, I will recognize you first, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Everybody, welcome to High Noon. And we're out in the street with us now. As I tell my kids when we go out camping and hiking, stay on the path. And Rockwell, you can help us stay on the path, right?
Great.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Bates, I will do
Thank
my
you.
Very best to do that.
Senate Bill 1580 provides legislative approval to the Oregon Health Authority to implement the Oregon Integrated and Coordinated Care Delivery System, including coordinated care organizations created during the 2011 legislative session in House Bill 3650. These CCOs would be accountable for achieving better health outcomes and cost savings in the Oregon Health Plan through improved coordination of care for both physical and behavioral health care. The Human Services Subcommittee approved amendments that added specific quarterly report requirements requiring CCOs to have a community advisory council and add specific criteria required of CCOs. The amendments also establish a work group on patient safety and defensive medicine under the direction of the governor to recommend legislation for the 2013 legislature. While passage of this bill is anticipated to result in savings for the Oregon Health Authority, at this time the savings and fiscal impact is indeterminate. OHA's legislatively adopted budget assumes a savings of $239 million general fund in the second year of the 2011-13 biennium as a result of transformation of the healthcare system. The cost savings generated by implementation of the new system are expected to constitute a portion of those anticipated budget savings. Your Human Services Subcommittee recommends Senate Bill 1580 be amended with the -8 amendments and reported out do pass as amended. That is the subcommittee's recommendation, the -8.
Thank you, Senator. I will. Is there any questions, Senator Bates, at this point, or with subcommittee's work?
Mr. Co-Chair, we're going to have several amendments here. Could we hold questions until we get to the last minute and then work backwards through them?
Yes.
Is that We'll appropriate under the rules?
Yes, we'll do so.
Thank you.
Very good.
Wait. Parliamentary issue.
Mm-hmm.
How do you have multiple amendments without debate on them if some are going to be easy and some are going to be controversial? Wouldn't you want to have separate motions on each one and debate on each one?
I'll let my co-chair respond here.
I think that we know that there are going to be, after this, which is the committee report being offered, there's going to be two more amendments. I think it would be appropriate then to debate the last amendment that's offered, then go to the amendment that's before that, because that would be the normal process, because the amendments would still be in, they would be in order, you know, in a sense, that you're debating the last amendment that's offered, that actually all the amendments have changes to the bill, so you debate the last first. It's the normal process in a committee, actually. It's a normal process in a committee to debate the last first.
It's biblical. The last shall be first.
Thank you. That's reassuring. At this point, I'll recognize Representative Nolan then.
In keeping with the conversation we just had,
we're going 8, 9, 7.
Mr. Co-Chair. This is not coming from the subcommittee, but from other work that has happened in the meantime. I will offer I will move that the committee also adopt the Dash 9 amendment, which amends the Dash 8 amendment by deleting three lines on the first page of the Dash 8. Specifically, on the Dash 8, which I think everybody has had a copy of, the Dash 9 amendment would delete lines 5, 6, and 7 of page 1 of the Dash 8.
Yes.
For the purpose of making sure that we protect the interests of hospitals that provide services for these patients.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Freeman, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Buckley. Before we start, I do need to declare a conflict of interest. I own a business. My family owns a business that could possibly do work with MCOs and now CCOs, and my wife works for a current managed care organization.
So noted.
That being said, I do want to read into the record some intent, so I apologize. It won't be my normal, elegant speech giving that you're so used to. That's a joke. So if this doesn't make complete sense, it really is directly related to this amendment to make sure we get legislative intent on the record.
Very good.
So House Bill 3650 set up an arbitration process for the specific situation of a healthcare entity and a potential CCO are not able to reach contract terms, but the entity is necessary for the CCO to be certified. In that context, an arbiter must be used to determine whether the healthcare entity has reasonable or unreasonable, whether the healthcare entity has reasonably or unreasonably refused to contract with the CCO applicant. HB 3650 says that a healthcare entity can refuse to contract if the proposed CCO reimbursement for services provided by the entity is below the reasonable cost to the entity for providing the service. A group of stakeholders, including health plans, hospital association, OMA, and other advocates, worked to develop a dispute resolution process as required by HB 3650. OHA will be adopting rules to implement this arbitration process. During the arbitration, the parties will have an opportunity to explain how the CCO contract offer is reasonable or unreasonable. For a federal or state statute or regulation establishes particular reimbursement requirements, examples A and B hospitals, federally qualified health care centers, rural health centers, providers of Indian services, those laws will be applied to determination by the arbitrator about whether the health care entity refusal to the contract is reasonable. The arbitrator will determine whether the decision to contract is reasonable or unreasonable. However, the goal for the parties is to reach an agreement themselves. If parties cannot agree, this would result in a non-contractual arrangement between the CCOs and the entity. If the CCO made a reasonable attempt to contract, this would not preclude the Oregon Health Authority from certifying the CCO. If the CCO made an unreasonable attempt, the Oregon Health Authority might not be able to certify the CCO if that entity was crucial for its certification. In the circumstances where there is a non-contractual arrangement between the CCO and the entity, the current status regarding how non-participating providers are reimbursed apply per House Bill 3650, Section 71. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. So let's say intent is that people act reasonably. To act reasonably.
We want everybody to please act reasonably.
Very good. Senator Whitstall, recognize you now.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Chair Buckley, I do not believe that the medical care transformation can be successful without significant medical liability reform. More important, virtually all the medical professionals that I have consulted with consider medical tort liability to be a primary cost driver for medical care delivery. They believe, as I do, that Senate Bill 1580 and moving 1580 forward without provision.
Did she not move the amendment?
No.
Mr. Chair, Senator, sorry to interrupt.
Sorry, Senator, my apologies.
I think we need to deal with the motion on the table, which is to replace the dash 8s with the dash 9s.
Thank you very much.
And then we can move on once that's taken care of.
Next minute.
Okay. Fair, yes. Put you on hold for a minute?
Sure.
All right, very good. Representative Noel, please.
Just to clarify my motion, since I now see it in writing from LC, I do move instead to substitute the dash 9 for the dash 8 instead of to amend the dash 8.
Very good. Is there a discussion on this motion, Representative Beats, please?
Just to be perfectly clear, the dash 9s have one other minor change to them that Representative Nola may not have been aware of, and that is that on Section 19, under the supervision of the governor, the authority now states may work with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Previous word was shall. It's a minor change, and it allows more leeway for the authority and for other parties to work together to maximize the federal funds. I don't think it's a major change. I just want to be sure everyone sees that so no one says later they looked at it. So how come this word wasn't brought up? And I want to follow up with what Representative Friedman said also. The purpose of this conversation on the dash 9s and to a degree the dash 8s, the dash 8s had confusing language in them. We've removed that language, the dash 9s. We want to make it clear that essentially what is in place already, that we're already doing with CCOs, is now transferred. I'm sorry, that we're doing with MCOs and hospitals is now transferred to CCOs. That process is transferred forward. And that's what this language does. We want to be clear about that. And that was what the discussions were. I think, from my understanding of those discussions, people agreed to that. There was huge confusion about the sentence we removed and actually dealt with some mistrust amongst members and stakeholders because it just wasn't clear. We've removed that language, and that's the key part of the dash 9s.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Winters, please.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, thank you. Because this is the first time we've seen or heard about the dash 9s, I would like for a brief recess.
Thank you.
This is a huge, huge piece of legislation when we start talking about health care transformation, and I just need to have to make certain that some of us have clarity and understanding before proceeding.
Absolutely, Senator, and I will place this in recess in a moment. I want to make sure, is there any other clarification that the members might need from Senator Bates or Representative Freeman prior to recess? And, Senator Berger, you were next on the list.
Yes, I was just going to express a similar request. I was not going to request any delay, but I really appreciate the work that they've done, and particularly if they've tried to correct language that has been very confusing or disturbing to some entity that need to cooperate in the future in this policy. I think the transformation policy is a good one. I think the changes are strongly supported in my district, but I do believe it is just unfair to bring this kind of changes to this kind of major legislation that we have to go back home and explain to people in such a quick manner. I have to put that on the record.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Freeman, did you want to comment on where we are at?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I'm happy that we want to make sure we get it right and take all the time necessary. All the dash 9 does is takes out a sentence that was confusing. Takes a sentence out. The sentence was supposed to clarify all that stuff I just read. Okay? It obviously did not, so we're taking it out. The shall and may word really is a very minor issue. It has to do with a specific hospital, and we have talked to them. They're fine with that change. Again, we can take all the time we need to get it right. We've got to get it right. Taking one sentence out that was confusing is what this amendment does.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Whitson, do you have a question on this one? Representative Smith.
I just want to put on the record, I'm very uneasy with this process right now.
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to Senator Rod, please.
Yeah, I have a question for Rep. Freeman. You read into the record quite a bit, and I'm just kind of curious, does that have to do with this amendment, or does it have to do with the body of the bill? Mm-hmm. If it has to do with this amendment, then we need clarity that you don't have to read something into the record. And I have to say, reading something into the record, just because you say you think it belongs here, doesn't mean that that's going to hold in law. And so I really, it bothers me if you feel strongly enough that you got to read something into the record, then maybe we need a dash 10.
Thank you, sir.
I believe the law is very clear that the current statute around non-participation is the law. We've been told that by our attorneys. We've been told that by the health authority. There is, however, many stakeholders that are affected in huge ways by this. We're talking about billions of dollars worth of healthcare delivery, and the fact that anytime we're changing any of the way that that's done, you've got people with lawyers stacked up around the block trying to figure out a way to get wiggle room. The idea of saying it, we try to have a sentence that made it clear. As you may realize, any time you say something, 10 different people read it different ways. The Attorney General and the AG, or the AG's office and the Department of Justice, both agree with us that the sentence was fine. I'm happy to take it out. I just want to be transparent and clear that everybody knows that the intent, the law, states that the current non-participation rate is going to be law moving forward with CCOs. We've been told by the health authority, we've been told by LC, we've been told everybody that's the case. I just want to say it on the record. It's not my interpretation, it's theirs.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would like to agree with my friend and colleague, Senator Girard. I think that given that there has been a respectful request for a recess, that it might be very helpful to have a copy of what you read into the record available to all the members of the committee so that we might have a chance to look at it. The length of the statement, I think, comes as a surprise to some of our colleagues here, and it would be, I think, informative and useful in this debate to have a copy.
Fine.
Thank you, Representative. At this point, then, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put us in a recess for at least 15 minutes. We'll try for a 15-minute conversation. I'd like to encourage members to speak with Representative Freeman, Senator Bates, Representative Kotick, I believe, is also available. Anyone who wants to get specific information on how the subcommittee worked with these amendments, so you're very clear. And again, as Representative Freeman stated, the major changes with the one word that Senator Bates mentioned and the removal of the sentence, hopefully we'll get clear on that is the motion that's in front of us currently. So we will stand in recess until 10:15. Yes.
Okay. We are back in session, members. Believe it or not, we are back in session. If our members would take their seats, appreciate it. Make sure we have a quorum, and we do. I don't want to, however, entertain this vote until we make sure we have.
Senator Edwards. Okay. Let's see if I can find Edwards.
Okay. Well, Mr. Richardson, please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The confusion that has grown here is because the dash nines contain all of the changes in wording and so forth that were in the dash eights. Okay. The dash eights were accepted by the subcommittee. All right. And were sent to us. The bill with the dash eights, that's what was sent to us. Now, the dash nines are dealing primarily with one sentence. The dash eights said that they were going to add the rate adopted by the authority that applies to a contractual health care entity shall be considered the reasonable cost for purposes of this section. That sentence was placed in the dash eights and has caused a lot of confusion. The dash nines takes that sentence out. It's not seen as an important sentence. That's why it's coming out. If we vote yes on the nines, we're saying that we sustain what was done in the subcommittee, except that we're taking one sentence out. If you want that sentence to stay in, vote no on the dash nines. If you don't care, let's vote yes, but let's move this process along, okay? Let's not make it more complicated than it is.
That was an excellent statement.
Amen.
I'd like to take exception with that. I think we're a better body than that. And I think if we're reading things into the record, and that we expect the courts to uphold what was read into the record, I disagree with that vehemently. I think we are a much better body than that. This is a very complex bill. It should not be rushed through. But for what I see, the nine is not a bad amendment.
Okay.
But I don't see that we have to be reading things into the record. And if we have to read the last two paragraphs into the record, we got a problem.
Very good.
I understand.
Thanks, sir. I would ask right now, is there any other discussion on Representative Nolan's motion on this amendment? Senator Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, just for absolute clarity, I would respectfully ask that Representative Nolan restate her motion.
Take a whack at it.
Thank you. The motion is to substitute the dash 9 amendment for the dash 8 amendment in the report from the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative. Is there objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion carries. Thank you very much. Senator Whitsitt, please. Thank you for being on pause. Now you're off pause, so please continue.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. I believe that moving the Senate Bill 1580 forward without provisions to transform that primary cost-driving issue will certainly cause the entire transformation attempt to fail. At a minimum, certain liability issues must be addressed. And for that reason, Chair Buckley, I respectfully move the Dash 7 amendments into Senate Bill 1580. The Dash 7 amendments do a number of things, and we'll go by section by section. In the first section, a coordinated care organization should be a public body only for the purpose of the Oregon Tort Claims Act. It would exempt the public meeting and collective bargaining and all other forms of that go along with the being a public body. Section 2, all medical providers and institutions that are participants in CCOs should be included for all medical services that they provide. It includes the entire suite of their business activities. Under Section 3, the CCO should collect assessments from all their participants to pay the cost of liability insurance and claims. In this way, the state should pay no part of the liability insurance costs. In Section 4, medical liability for CCOs and all other participants should have the same limits as those for cities, counties, and other small government entities under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. And finally, on Section 5, It becomes effective October 1st, 2013, which I believe gives adequate time for alternate medical liability limits to be proposed and enacted should they be provided. That's simply the 5 points of the dash seven.
Thank you, Senator. I'd like to offer the opportunity for any members to ask questions of Senator Whitson on this representative.
Very briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have consistently said that some sort of medical malpractice reform, some sort of cost curve on the expensive medicine is a very vital part of this bill, and I will be supporting this amendment.
Thank you, Representative. Is it for Senator Girod and Senator Bates?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, I don't know if many of you know, but I practiced in Canada. I practiced under the Canadian healthcare system, and Canada is rich. It has rich in natural resources. It also does not have much of a military. But the big thing about the Canadian healthcare system and what they enacted was they had major tort reform. And major case up there would not run in the millions like it does here. It runs in the thousands. My medical malpractice when I started there, now granted it was a few years ago, was less than $100. So if you want to enact something that resembles the Canadian healthcare system, and this is the direction we're going, then by God, at least take part of it, the cost containment part of it, and that's medical malpractice. We don't make use of our natural resources like Canada does, and we definitely want to have a military. So, you know, we're going to go bankrupt if we enact this system without having some cost containment.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bates, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There's probably someone in this building wants tort reform more than I do. I just haven't met him yet. As you all know, I'm a practicing physician. The fear, loathing, and cost of health to health care and to practitioners about being sued is really unbelievable until you've seen your colleagues go through it. That said, the real issue here is defensive medicine, the cost of defensive medicine. The real issue in this bill is that we're not quite sure what the best thing to do is at this point. We are close. We have five or six different ideas of what the best direction to go is. But we need time to consider those, think about them, and come back in 2013 and do it. That's why in the Dash 9 amendments, embedded in that is a task force for having a serious discussion led by a governor who has previously brought us tort reform and who's committed to bringing us tort reform again. He did it back in the 1980s. The courts overturned some of that. But we need to get back in and really figure out what is the best thing to do. Is it pretrial issues? Is it caps? Is it setting up an entire different system for handling claims? There are a multitude of ways to go about this, and we don't know which one really pays off. I appreciate my colleagues bringing this forward. I agree with them on the need for this. I just don't agree that this is the method we should go through doing it.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Co-Chair Devlin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Whitsitt, just a question about the amendment. My reading of the amendment would say, and I'm not going to use this entity just because I think this entity performs a very valuable service in my district, but I'll just use it because it's in my district. If Meridian Park Hospital is part of a CCO, would this amendment say that if an Oregon Health Plan patient is in that hospital, they would be covered under these new tort limits, but also that any other patient, even though they're not part of the Oregon Health Plan, would be covered by these tort limits?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, it appears to say that any CCO that provides services, that all the services they provide that are of a healthcare nature or medical nature are covered under these tort limits. It does not appear to make the distinction between Oregon Health Plan recipients that might be part of the receiving service from the CCO and the general public.
I believe it's the intent of the amendment to include the full suite of services provided by a medical professional who is a member of a CCO.
So literally all patients then.
Thank you, sir.
So if I choose to basically go to a non-participating medical provider in the CCO, I will have one set of remedies And if I go to any provider that's under CCO, I will have a different set of remedies.
That is an imperfection in this amendment. We see the same imperfection in the Oregon Tort Claims Act between whether you're suing the state or whether you're suing a small government entity. They have a different set of caps.
Well, thank you, Senator Whitsitt. I just, you know, I know that all of the discussion here of medical malpractice is strongly felt by people on both sides of the discussion. I just think any prospect of any sort of tort reform that would give one set of Oregonians one set of rights and another set of Oregonians a different set of rights, I would have significant problems with.
Well, if I may respond to that, we already have that under the Oregon Tort Claims Act.
Thank you, Senators. Senator Winters, did you wish to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, we're undertaking a huge transformation in this state, and I'm reminded that we've been talking access, affordability, cost containment, changes in our healthcare system since I began having the healthcare summits, I believe it was in 2003 or someplace back there, a long time in history. And a part of that conversation you can't talk about without talking about in cost containment of medical mal and defensive medicine. We know that we're practicing that defensive medicine is a part of the cost drivers when we talk about the healthcare delivery system. And so, you know, I asked myself the question, we've been having the debate, the discussion, in what iteration or the other, and yet, you know, we're talking about we can't really address it now through the -7 amendments. And I asked my question, if not now, when? You know, I look at Texas and other states, California and others who have, you know, undertaking this discussion. It's not like we're plotting new ground. It's not like we're blazing the trail. It's not like that it doesn't exist everywhere. The big state of Texas can come to grips with this particular issue. I don't know why Oregon cannot. And I put that there because if we're going to truly, in this state, come to grips with the issue of access, affordability, and cost containment. We have to address it. This is a piece of what occurs. My good doctor here, he and I start talking about these issues when he became a legislator in 1999 and I became a legislator in 1999. So, you know, I think this is 2012.
This is, sir.
So I still raise the question, if not now, when?
Thank you, sir. Senator Edwards, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put on the record that while I will be voting against the adoption of the -7s, I want it to be noted that I am a member of the legislature that wants to see significant Med-Mal reform, and I want to see it in 2013.
Thank you, Senator.
I want to see it in 2013. I want a significant bill to vote on. I believe in the good faith statements of Senator Bates. I believe that others that have wanted to move this policy forward as well, that are really integral in the debate about healthcare reform, do want to tee something up for next session. I want to be able to vote on that policy. I think it's really complicated, and I'm not prepared to, you know, vote on something of that magnitude, having, you know, seen this for, you know, a very short amount of time this morning. But I do hope that we take it up in 2013 and there will be a significant bill to vote on.
Thank you, Senator. For members who have not had a chance to read the report that OHA did have done as part of this legislation, the consultants came back, did list several options, and hope that we all could enter into that discussion.
Just two quick comments. Hope is not a strategy. We potentially could save $20 million by doing this. So what are we about?
Thank you, Senator. Not seeing any further discussion, I would like to ask for a roll call vote on the motion, please. This is adopting Senator Whitsitt's proposed amendment.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Senator Bates?
Unfortunately, no.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
No.
Senator Girard?
Yep.
Senator Edwards?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Devlin?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Comp?
No.
Representative Byer?
No.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
No.
Vice Chair Girard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nathanson?
No.
Co-Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Buckley?
No.
That motion fails.
Motion fails. Thank you. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Rocca, but we are now back to Representative Nolan's motion, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. Any further discussion on Representative Nolan's notion for the dash nines? I'm sorry.
I believe, Mr. Co-Chair, we have voted to substitute that, so you would now be on the main motion.
Okay, now the bill has amended.
You're on adopting the bill as amended.
All right. Back to Senator Bates' original motion. So is there any discussion on adopting the bill as amended? Further discussion?
That would be the dash nine.
The dash nine has been adopted to the bill as amended.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Co-Chair, first of all, I want to share my appreciation with the committee. This is heavy lifting, and no matter what your party is, thank you. So, Senator Bates, as I look at the pony that was in my packet, in the third paragraph, it talks about assumed savings of $239 million. And I'm assuming this question has been asked over and over and over again in committee. Can you share with us, for those who are not on the committee, what is the consequence if that assumption is incorrect? And perhaps that question moves more to the co-chairs.
Let me start by answering. The co-chairs may want to chime in here. I'm answering in two parts if I'd be allowed to. One, if this bill were to fail, then the opportunity to obtain approximately or up to $500 million of federal funds for CCOs in the second half of this biennium is lost. Now, the actual expected savings that we think we could achieve through transformation in the second half of the biennium is not $329 million. And let's all of us will be clear, that's general fund money. Total funds is more like $600 to $700 million, which would devastate the Oregon Health Plan, would devastate hospitals, devastate provider bases. It's something we really just can't tolerate in the system. I think the net result would be disenrollment of patients from these plans, and most patients going to the emergency rooms of our hospitals where they have to be seen. That's sort of how this thing rolls out if you don't do this. We expect that we would get $60 to $80 million of actual savings in the second half of the biennium, not the amount listed there. But the money coming from the feds on this should be able to fill that gap to a level that is feasible for us to close the budget gap and complete the biennium. And that money is probably going to continue to come into the state for several years afterwards as we go through this huge change. Not wanting to belabor the point, the reason the feds are willing to do this is not because they like us or we're good people here. They're looking at a national disaster in Medicaid and Medicare that can break the federal government. We're talking about a savings in this program that will go on nationwide over a 10-year period of time would be over $1 trillion. These are the kind of things we need to do to reform the healthcare system, not only from the point of view of patient care, but cost. And when I keep going back to the same old number, we spend twice as much money as any other industrialized country in the world on health care per population. We can't keep doing that, and it keeps accelerating. We have to make changes. If we don't, we'll break the system. Now, I don't know if I actually answered your question, but I hope I did.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
I don't think I asked my question correctly. It assumes savings. Is there a reason why we're not able to nail that down to have a hard number of what the savings will be? Can you walk me through that?
The reason we can't nail that down is that we don't know how fast and how quickly these CCOs can form and become effective. Certain parts of the state Roseburg is an example where Representative Freeman's from, is really moving forward. They'll probably become active nearly around July, August, or September. Other parts of the state have more complex issues. Some of them are very large systems. They're having great conversations. They're trying to come together, but they're not likely to get together as fast as we'd like to fill that budget hole. And I think the co-chair probably would like to have a few words here.
Yeah, let your co-chair, Representative Freeman, also respond to you.
Thank you, and appreciate this opportunity. This has been a huge question throughout this policy work. Keep in mind, the lion's share of this policy work was done before there was any offer of federal buy down money, whatever you want to call it. The policy is designed around the fact that the current system is unsustainable. The growth and the increase of the cost to provide these services is just completely unsustainable. The policy work that's been done and the idea of coordinating is going to work to give the ability for communities to deliver this care with what is going to be less money. There will be less money because there will be less money for us to give. There's just no magic pot of money out there. So I am always frustrated with the term savings that continues to show up. I continue to say this, that whether there is actual savings or just the ability to deliver these services the best they can with what is less money, it's of no consequence which way you say it. The fact is that we're going to have less money. We're given a care delivery system to provide better care into the future in our communities, regardless of the amount of money that we have to spend. So I just want to make sure everybody's clear that there is no magic number of $240 million. They've run all kinds of scenarios that show us there will be savings by doing this. But ultimately, the fact that we won't be funding the system at the higher rate will be what will be the savings.
Just one follow-up, if I may, Mr. Smith.
Yeah. One more question on this, and again, this is for a person who didn't serve on the committee. It talks about the assumption of the $239 million in the second year, and I understand that. Share with the committee what the future trend of savings will be. What can we expect to see in 3 biennium, in 5 biennium?
We have a report. Can I answer that?
Yes, please.
We have a report that I can make available to you, and it's in the billions of dollars. And that report is done by actuaries.
Can I interrupt? I just want to.
And what we're starting to do is we're not going to flatten this thing. We're bending that cost curve down to a level that we think we can sustain with general fund dollars.
Okay, so just one last clarification.
Please.
Thank you. So as we read this, we should not assume this is a one-time savings, but rather
No. We're
going to expect to see a trend of savings.
Right. And let's be honest, we're not going to see healthcare costs drop below what they are now. The cost curve is at close to a 40-degree angle. We can bend that down to where it's close to, and our goal is to get it to general inflation so that we have an opportunity to keep funding these programs. Representative Freeman is actually correct. What really drove this? We don't have to do this. We could take $239 million out of somewhere else in the budget, put it in here, and continue our present programs.
Okay.
I don't think there's the political will to do that in this building, and I think there might be some people who would feel uncomfortable us talking about that.
Thank you for indulging my question.
I'm going to go to Co-Chair Richardson, Senator Gerard, and then Co-Chair Devlin. Co-Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to respond to the rest of your question as to what happens if it doesn't come in, by way of kind of background, we've had some real challenges in the budget from the very beginning for this biennium. So we, the co-chairs, agreed, and our caucuses agreed, and the assembly agreed to a budget when we came out of the session last year. That budget had certain assumptions. About $650 million was assumed that would be there somehow. One piece of that was $239 million assumed from transformation would be saved in the second year. So that can got kicked down to February. So here we are in February, and we came together, and basically because of changes, adjustments, and circumstances, we're looking at about $439 million worth of a hole that we had to deal with. But we are also ensured that the $239 million can be dealt with. So that brought it down to about $200 million, which is the basis for our rebalance. The $239 million assumption that it's going to be filled is not going to be filled the way it might have been anticipated a year ago. Most of it is because the federal government now has said you know, we like what you're doing. We understand that savings are not going to be immediate, that there's a transition period. And so to help seed this, you know, to prime the pump for what Oregon is doing, we will give some number. Maybe it's $500 million. That's the number that gets mentioned each year for 5 years. That $500 million, that's a total amount, but if you added to that some of the savings that's being planned with the CCOs and so forth, it is anticipated, assumed, that it will cover the $239 million in the next year. What happens if it doesn't is we come to the session in next year, the 2013 session, and we'll get a rebalance again. And we'll find out the good news. It was actually $240 million. Or maybe it's $200 million. If it's less than $239, then we will be confronted then with another rebalance issue for the difference of the $239 and what really has occurred. And we hope and assume that things will be just fine. If not, we will deal with it then. And so we had this huge problem, and what's turning out is we're dealing with it in increments. We're now in the second year of this biennium. We could have a very interesting final quarter of this two-year biennium if things don't work out real well. But we are making the assumption that the 239 is going to be there. All indications from resources are that it's going to happen, and we now go forward and see you next year as we evaluate how successful that's been.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Rudd, please.
Well, thank you. Colleagues, I think these savings are hypothetical. And it's a rainbow, and we are marching to that. And what we're dependent on isn't the $239 million in savings. It's the $500 million carrot that the Obama administration says to throw at us. Are we going to get more for less? I've been in the legislature a long time. I've been promised that I don't know how many times, and I have yet to see it. What we have in this nation right now is a giant market failure. You have no reason not to consume, and you have no reason not to provide. What happens? Price goes up. So what are we doing? We're loading up the consumption rate, and then we're saying, oh, by the way, we're going to try to hold down the cost by putting all these restrictions on people. What happens? What happens when you do that? Look at the Oregon Health Plan. I voted for it. I supported it. I was one of the people that would, you know, join the club, and as a dentist, I saw patients that were on the Oregon Health Plan. You know, no one took the darn plan. I had patients from, I live in Staten. I had patients from Bandon. I had them from Astoria. I had them from Eastern Oregon. This is what you're heading down. When you head down a managed care to the massive state that you are proposing in this bill, it is a disaster beyond belief, and we got to quit selling the future of future generations.
Makes sense. Put your devil, please.
I appreciate all the comments of my colleagues from both chambers. I think one of the things that we really need to understand is our problem is not our problem alone as a state. Many of us actually work on other areas outside this building in terms of people that we talk to. I've been in a position for about 10 years where I regularly talk to appropriations chairs from states all over the nation. Their actual biggest problem that they are dealing with is within their budgets is the growing cost of Medicaid. It is an item that is actually often referred to as the item that is busting their budget, that is actually displacing other essential public services. And what I will tell you is, while there are many of those that are actually trying to do some of the same things that we're doing, is that we are actually, in a sense, in the lead on this. Now, one of the things that's been talked about here are these savings, and obviously there have been studies since the original expectation that would lower that expectation in the second year of this biennium. And it is the inclusion of the federal dollars, additional federal dollars, is, I believe, basically why Representative Richardson said that the co-chairs are confident that we can now cover this area. But people should make no mistake about this. The transformation additional dollars will not come unless we actually take this step. The co-chair's real alternative to them is something that people don't like to hear, but it is the reality. There are no dollars in this budget to move to fill that hole. The budgets that we have in our other two major areas, in public safety and in education, are at historic levels in terms of not necessarily always how low they are, but how tight they are. Your co-chairs, looking at your subcommittee's recommendations, are often discussing right now how to fix $250,000 problems in the budget. There is no way to fill this hole. Our only alternative out there, and I think all the health care providers that are here should be cognizant of those that are occasionally critical of this effort, our only alternative is to go back in and not go back into the other budgets, but go back into the Oregon Health Authority and start actually cutting services, actually probably petitioning the federal government in terms of which services that you will cover, and probably even petitioning the federal government over issues of eligibility. That is our alternative. People talk about this savings as if all we would have to do is just fill the savings and we wouldn't have to do this transformation. Ladies and gentlemen, we are trying to basically do what we both talked about, live within our means. And to live within our means and to perform the basic services that our citizens expect, we need to take these actions.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Winters, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just have a question because there's been a lot of discussion about transformation dollars and the assumption of savings, and I too agree that I don't think we're going to have any savings because the reality is that we are seeing a growing cost of Medicaid. But I would like to ask, the carrot that's out there is the $500 million that could translate over 5 years to $2.5 million. None of us have seen any document nor anything in writing from the current administration, from the Obama administration, that in fact exists. And I know that we can't bind future legislative action here, and you know we've got an election coming up. We don't know whether the current president's going to be the current president. So help me understand how we are either banking on part of. My history with the federal government is that they can be just as skitsy as. Well, it's true. You know, you may say one day we've got this coming to you states, and the next day it doesn't appear. And I put that out because I hope we're not counting on $2.5 billion in order to address our own medical program. And I just want to know if I've asked before from the administration, from Goldberg and others, give me some kind of document or correspondence that you're having with your federal counterparts to give us some kind of assurance that something is coming in the future. And I don't know whether the leaders have received anything or not.
Senator Bates, would you like to respond? And hopefully,
Representative Freeman, he's anxious to make a comment, and I'll follow him.
Representative Freeman, please.
Thank you. I want to be clear. I share your concern. We have not seen the stuff in writing. Regardless of whether we get the money or not, changing the healthcare system to a coordinated, local-controlled system is the right thing to do. The policy is sound regardless of the $500 million promised by the federal government. If we are going to deliver these services with less money, we're better to let our communities figure out how best to make those cuts and not do it at a state level equally across the state.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, I'd close real quickly, and then I'm going to ask for a vote.
I want to be clear on this, too, because Senator Winters has asked a very legitimate question, and I appreciate that. We do not have absolute assurance this money will be available. The governor has personally gone back to Washington, D.C., talked to CMS along with Dr. Goldberg and others. There is pretty strong assurance that money will be available before the election, frankly. Will it be $500 million? That's been part of the discussion. Okay. Will it be $500 million? I have no idea. Anything we can get for this will help. And even if we only get half that money, it will help the second half by any. Remember, the gap is really $600 or $700 million. If we were to get $500 million, there's still a gap.
and we have to get some savings to make up that difference. And Representative Freeman is absolutely correct. If this isn't what you want to do, if you don't want to give local control to our communities, to the best kind of health care they can for our communities, you tell us what you want us to do. Because we have no other plan that we think is viable and really will work. And I don't see any place else in the United States doing it. This is a landmark piece of legislation. We need to pass it out now.
Thank you. I've made a commitment on time. I'm trying not trying to limit conversations. I'm going to ask for a vote. If people want to discuss it after the vote, I do need to get my co-chair out of here, as I have promised him to do. I'll be happy to continue the conversation. Before I ask for a roll call, I want to express my personal thanks to Senator Bates, Representative Freeman, Representative Kotek, members of the SUD, the members of the Policy Committee. Incredible, detailed, complicated work, and I'm very grateful for your work. Mr. Rock, would you please call for a roll call?
Senator Winters?
No.
Senator Bates?
Yes.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Gerard?
Hell no.
Senator Edwards?
Hell yes.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
As a gesture of appreciation for the progress made today with the clarifications represented by the dash nines, I'm going to provide an aye vote. I respectfully reserve the right to vote no on the Senate floor when the bill comes before us next week. Aye.
Co-Chair Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I vote no, but reserve the right to change my vote on the floor. For the record, I've worked with Central Oregon leaders and Mr. Mike Bonetta.
It's just a vote.
Well, I didn't have an opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So was your vote, his vote recorded?
Yes, Mr. Chair. No.
Thank you.
Correct.
Correct. I did ask for time to help.
Representative Nolan?
I like it today. I'll like it tomorrow. I'll like it next week. Yes.
Representative Kahn?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
Yes.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Cohen?
Yes.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gerard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nathanson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Members of the, thank you, Representative Richardson. Happy travels. Best of luck.
I got a flight that I was supposed to be.
He's supposed to be glad at 10:30 to catch his flight. Members, if anybody, I don't want to cut off conversation. I will hold the meeting open for a moment. Senator Nelson, did you want to make a comment? My apologies for cutting you off.
We can have it both ways, you know. Whatever the federal money is, pick up another $20 million of savings with tort reform. I mean, maybe I should talk with Senator Thompson, because he's one of these guys, a pear farmer, who's never received a government subsidy, but I'm a wheat farmer, and I've lived my whole life on government subsidies. So why don't we just take it all?
Thank you, Senator. With that, I'm going to thank all the members for their time, consideration, and their work today, and we are adjourned.